Hey, thanks for joining me again on The Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis. On today's podcast, a smuggler, an innovator, and a savvy businessman. And they're all the same guy. It's a story of smuggling and lessons learned that led to incredible, unexpected success. Let's hit the road to meet the self-proclaimed John fucking Caldwell.
So I hand him my passport.
Oh, I see you're from California. So what were you doing over here this morning?
Oh, I just went over to check the falls out and have breakfast. Pulled the keys out and give it to him. And he opens up the back and, what are these? Oh, they're clear glass. The look on his face is like, man, you're stupid.
Yeah.
Get up to my office.
John has to be one of the most outrageous characters I've interviewed. He experienced early success, had unapologetic style and impatience that drove him to smuggling grapevines. That's about half of his story. The result of his smuggling created an unexpected turn that helped finance his current success. He walks with a cane due to a bout with polio as a child, but as you'll hear, that did not slow him down. By listening, you may think him brash and arrogant, but then you'll find he's self-deprecating, thoughtful, and a pleasant guy. Today's interview will have five chapters. The first, early success. Caldwell Vineyard is in the Coombsville region of South Napa Valley. We did the interview in a corner of his kitchen. We were across from a small table from one another that gets knocked and kicked from time to time. I began by telling him I was inclined to jump right into the smuggling story, but I have this image of him driving through Napa Valley in the 1970s in a black Cadillac, wearing gold chains with his shirt nearly unbuttoned.
And that's a detail I can't pass up that I read about on your website. So your initial success began in the shoe business and inspired by a pair of Danish clogs.
It's reality is so much more crazy than fiction. I mean, it's really true.
Sometimes, yeah.
What really happened is one day I was picking up some clogs for my mother. She had a bath shop in Yountville.
Okay.
This is in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a stockbroker for a while. And so I just go down to the importer, and when I come up to see mom and dad, I'd bring two or three cases of clogs, and she was selling the shit out of them. So one day I'm at the importer, and I said, well, what's going on here? My mom's selling these things out of her bath shop. And he says, well, they're hot right now. You know, this, we just started a few years ago importing them, and Christ, we're selling the hell out of them. We got a line of, here, you know, are you interested in shoes? We got a line of shoes from Brazil, and we got this and that. And so I started looking at all this stuff. I said, what would it take to open up a shoe store? So I'm thinking if you could sell clogs.
You could sell high heels.
Yeah, you could sell high heels. So one thing leads to another. Well, so I called my brother, and he was living in Yountville. And all he was doing was painting, you know, painting houses. This is back in the 60s.
Yeah, like 68?
69, yeah. And, I mean, Yountville was not Yountville of today.
No.
It was the armpit of Napa Valley, and you could buy a house for $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Called my brother, and he said, yeah, let's do it. So anyway, so we start. Well, the darn thing takes off.
Hmm.
The timing was perfect. It started getting busier and busier and busier, and pretty soon we had good little, so we opened up another little shoe store in the same complex. We only had 375 square feet. You can't run a shoe store, really, 300 with your stock room. But so we had it upstairs. We had shoes everywhere. I mean, it was just stupid.
So you decided to expand.
Yeah, so we decided to expand. So we opened up another location. So now we had two. And business kept growing. And, yeah, it was profitable. I ran it every day. It was kind of fun. Had enough money to buy a Cadillac. A used Seville, black Seville.
Not it was black. One, you don't see many black Cadillacs.
Black on black. It was sexy.
Wow.
It was really sexy. I loved that car. So anyway, but I was in the fashion business. So how do you dress? Come on. Silk shirts, button down to here. You got to show your hairy chest.
Yeah.
You got to have some gold chains hanging around your neck, gold bracelets. And that was John fucking Caldwell back then. Now, they didn't call me that back then. They just called me John, you know.
What I think is funny is you set the tone for opulence in Yountville before Jean-Charles Boisset.
Oh yeah, I was way before Jean-Charles. Oh, absolutely.
That would be Jean-Charles back in the 70s.
That's right. I was way before Jean-Charles.
So you had some money to invest, and you had your eye on this former dairy farm in Coombsville that sat on 54 acres.
It sat on 54 acres, right.
And you thought,
It was 120,000.
We were at like 70, 74 now?
Okay. 74. That house was here, this was here, and the guest house. So there was three houses here. They were all run down. I mean, this did not look like this.
Hmm.
You couldn't finance property back then. They wouldn't even touch it, the banks. I mean, they had no real value for the property. This is Coombsville.
Yeah, so Napa Valley had not become what
it had. Napa Valley had not become. It was a farming valley. Banks just didn't even want a loan on this stuff. So the lady was willing to take the mortgage at 7%, and she wanted 20% down, which was 24,000. That was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I had $5,000 in my checking account in the shoe store, and I offered her that as the down payment, and she took it.
Wow.
Lucky. So for $5,000 and 74, I got 54 acres with three houses on it.
You know, this story seems to be prevalent throughout your whole history. This good luck and...
just a lot of really the timing. Uh-huh. I look back and I go, you are just a lucky son of a... But I was always sniffing, though. You know, I mean...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I was out there looking for things, and sometimes things came up like this, and I thought, there's no way I could really lose. I'll fix the houses up and sell them.
You were going to parcel the land, too.
Yeah, I was going to parcel it out.
Planning on building like a little neighborhood or something?
I was going to break it into 5-10s. And the county at that time, this was zoned R1A, which means 1 acre minimum. So I thought, like, I'll break it into 5-10s. They'll give me 10 acres. And by God, they gave me approval in the planning commission. I built that road on the planning commission approval. And before it got finaled, the county went into a moratorium right after that.
Yeah.
And this became 40 acre minimum out of that one. They rezoned the whole valley. They changed the general plan.
Oh.
They wanted to stop growth.
Mm-hmm, right.
Which, you know, back then I was all pissed off. I'd never tell they did me the biggest favor in my life, but they did.
So you had one bit of a hiccup, but it ended up turning out to be a good thing after all.
Turned out to be the best thing. Yeah. I can't imagine what I'd have been doing the rest of my life. Had I got the 10 acres, sold a couple of them. I was taking sailing lessons, and I was going to buy a 44-footer. It was a Hong Kong boat, and move into it and take off around the world.
Oh.
79. Well,
that would have been an interesting turn.
You never know where it ended up. I'm sure, I love the joke about it. Being, you know, kind of a cowboy, I'd probably gotten into the Orient there, probably wanted to stay around Thailand, you know. Heck, you know, some things were happening, action. Probably got into the drug business because it's easy. You don't have to have a big inventory, you know.
Right. You had a boat.
Probably gotten caught because I always got caught if I did anything wrong. I'd probably still be in a Cambodian jail today with no teeth right into my congressman. Get me out of this place.
If you were still alive.
If I was still alive. So I'm glad the county changed the zoning on me.
At this point in his story, now that he has some land, his friend said, why don't you grow some grapevines?
And as your website says, turn that land that once supported livestock into a cash cow. I love that line. But it gave you the opportunity to plant vineyards.
Well, so then, you know, back then, I mean, everybody pretty much knew everybody. I used to trade shoes for wine. You know, I remember Michael Mondavi, Tim coming in with a case of Cabernet, you know, and trading me for some Freiburgs and stuff like that. So you knew everybody. It was only a few people in the wine business. It was a very small business.
Right. Like that.
So you knew them all, but they needed grapes. Chardonnay took off. And this was a good Chardonnay area. So people, why don't you plant some Chardonnay, Caldwell? I'll buy it from you. Mm-hmm. So that's what got me going.
And like you tend to do, your nature is to dive wholeheartedly into what you get into. And you were devouring all kinds of information on grape growing. And this brought to you the attention of the research the French were doing on grape clones.
That was really fortuitous. That was another one of these timing things, being at the right place at the right time. And it was actually at Chateau Aubryon, one of the first growths, in 1982. They took us around. I paid a guy to take me, Gallo McLean, and he was a graduate of the University of Bordeaux. So they kind of, I wasn't just a normal, you know,
right
person walking in. They gave us a really good tasting. Ended up in a room about 1,500 square feet that was just set up for their clonal program. Hmm. And I didn't even know what a clone was, but here's this very sophisticated room with a computer. And they had around three walls, there was a little shelf with these micro vinifications, probably about 10-15 liters per stainless steel vinification. Hmm. And wires running to a computer. So it was all...
Wow.
This is 82.
Yeah.
They didn't have laptops back then.
No.
It was the size of that counter over there. It was huge. So one thing leads to another. I get all fired up. I see what they're doing. They gave me some information about it. I remember getting back to my hotel reading about clones, and I went, man, whatever these guys have, I want them for my vineyard. Because look to me, because at that time, California... Well, even today we don't, but certainly back then we didn't have any research on clonal material at all.
Even Davis wasn't providing much?
No, zero. Hmm. There was nothing available. They had Dr. Omo, who was a fabulous guy, on his own almost created just the clones that we had at that time. There was just one mother vine of Cabernet, clone 7 and 8. There was one mother vine of Merlot, clone 1 and 3. One mother vine of Cab Franc clone 2, and the Cab Franc was a terrible clone. Olmo did those all. He did wonderful research pretty much all on his own, but that was all it was.
It's interesting, because a lot of very talented winemakers who are still working today came out of Davis about that time, a little before that, and
well,
after Chile, after that.
It was the... Davis was, in when it came to winemaking, it was a world leader back then.
So you return home, you're excited about what the French are doing with their varietals, and you went to speak to UC Davis about the importing clones from France, but they warned you that, well, you have to quarantine and do some testing to ensure that they're not diseased, which is still in place today. Mm-hmm. So that held you off a little bit.
Well, the reason I would have done it had it been in a time frame that would be realistic. It takes 7 years to do it. If you bring them in legally.
Right.
You bring it in, you give it to a quarantine facility like Davis. That takes 2 years of research on your clones there.
2 years?
2 years. And then you don't get the material until the third year. So now you got 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what you get is a pot, a little tiny pot. That's what you get out of a greenhouse.
Right.
So you get one of those.
4 or 6 inch pot.
Yeah, 4 or 6 inch pot. You get that in the third year. Now you got to plant that thing to get it to grow big so that you can take cuttings off. And the cuttings have to be the size of your, you know, like your little finger, uh-huh, your canes, so that you can take those buds and graft them on a rootstock so phylloxera doesn't kill it. Mm. By the time you go through this whole process, it's 7 years before you got enough wood to plant a vineyard. Well, in 1982, I didn't have 7 years to
to wait. That's an investment.
It's just time. You can't. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, I had to plant a vineyard.
Well, I know what you wanted to do.
And that brings us to Chapter 2, the smuggling. Once the soil was prepared for planting, along with his Chardonnay, he also planted 2 hydrothermographs to record the variation in moisture and temperature. It turned out the region was warmer than he was led to believe, which allowed him to plant the preferred vines of Cabernet Sauvignon, Cab Franc, and Merlot. A year later, in 1982, John took a trip to France and found desirable Bordeaux clones at a nursery, which he couldn't easily obtain.
So when I came home, I contacted him, and he said, yeah, you know, next year I'll have maybe 6,000, 7,000, or 8,000 of Cab, Merlot, Cab Franc.
Wow.
Already grafted vines. So, wow, this would put
Bing.
Me bingo, right? Yeah. So I flew up there in the fall of 83, and everything was legit. In fact, it was a grant from the University of Toronto, so it was a very high-level importation. So I said, I'll buy them all. And he said, well, I think I have, I'm fine. So,
and they were like $1.35 a piece?
They were...
American?
Yeah, maybe $1.50.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, what a deal.
Yeah.
So I bought them all. Everything was set up for me to come up then the following winter in 84 to somehow get them 6,000 vines
That's
across the border.
Quite a heap.
You can't put those down your pant leg.
And you were getting them in the wintertime because they were dormant.
They're dormant. So you can, just as long as you keep them below 40 degrees, they'll stay dormant.
So how do you get them across the border? And then the other challenge was, it was winter.
It was winter. And that was a challenge. It was 9 degrees in Buffalo, and I rented a rent-a-wreck. It was a 79 Impala, and I had a place to stay. Family knew the people on the Canadian side, so I had a place to stay. And I was worried about the temperature because I'd have to go back and forth with them in the back, and they will freeze. And if they freeze, you know, you can lose your vine. So it was some, it was a factor. Yeah. It wasn't that cold to do that, but I was worried about it. It gets cold up there.
Yeah, yeah, and ice too on the roads.
Oh, yeah, it's
cold. You had to deal with that. But interestingly, it turned out to be an older woman who helped you get those across the
border. I'm staying with this couple. Wonderful people. They had a little vineyard themselves. So one morning I'm getting ready to start my smuggling, and Kathleen says, John, you know, Richard and I were talking last night, and we think it's too risky for you to do it. I'm going to do it for you.
Wow.
So in the back of her Mercedes, she went back and forth.
She was his mother?
What?
She was his mother?
Wife.
Oh, wife. Oh. Yeah. So he was an older...
They were both in their 60s. Okay. Yeah. He was an attorney there in a little town.
Yeah, he was an attorney who ended up being a good contact a little later.
Yes. And he got my ass out of the tight situation.
Yeah.
you read about that.
Yeah. And so Kathleen...
His wife.
Few trips.
And she went back and forth. Yeah, brought... worked out to be net. It was about almost 6,000 vines or 5,800 vines, something like that. She brought 4,300 across... in the back of her Mercedes. Three trips.
And yeah, so she was in her 60s. They didn't think anything up.
Little lady driving back and forth, you know, going shopping in Niagara Falls. No big deal.
But then she, after four trips, she said, well, I've had enough.
Yeah, and there was still about 1,400 vines left over on a Sunday morning, and she said, I just don't feel good today. She was not in good health. She was a trooper. And I said, okay, Kathleen. So I got in my car, went over and loaded up the last of the order. And it was around 1,400 vines. Thank God it was mostly Merlot. The Cab and the Cab Franc came over first. So at the border, you want me to tell you what I did at the border?
Sure. I mean, if I have to edit it out, I'll edit it out.
So I pull up. I wasn't very smart. You know, I was a cocky little roach. And I'm in a bunch of long lines, and they're moving slow, you know. And a brand new bay opens up right next to the headquarters office. It was about 10 or 15 bays. Now, a good smuggler would have stayed in the long lines. They're going off duty, you know. Don't get a fresh guy, right?
Yeah.
Well, don't get a fresh guy.
Well, but if you're impatient, you see a lane open and you want to get in there.
And so I got about 6 or 7 cars in front of me. I've been back and forth 4 or 5 times. Nobody's ever checked anything. So I pull over. I'm probably his first or second car. So I hand him my passport. And he looks at it. Oh, I see you're from California. Yeah, I'm from California. So what were you doing over here this morning, over in Canada? Oh, I just went over to check the falls out and have breakfast. How were the falls? Well, they were, you mentioned how cold it gets up there.
Yeah.
They were frozen. There wasn't any visible fall. Just some water.
It's still beautiful when it's frozen.
Still, yeah, yeah. Quite as, I said, well, there weren't any falls this morning. I guess it gets really cold. Yeah, it gets pretty cold around here. Let me have your keys. So... pull the keys out and give it to him, and he opens up the back. And what are these? Oh, they're grapevines. Well, what are they doing in your trunk? I said, well, I bought them here yesterday and just went, oh, yeah, that's right. Just went over to have breakfast and checked the phone. Tell your story to my boss. So he goes in the booth and calls, and the boss comes down. And the boss chit-chats with him a little bit and then walks over to me. And
are you getting nervous yet, or are you still
I knew I'm fucked, that I'm going to lose the vines. So I knew I'd lost them. He says, so I understand you bought these in New York. And what are they? I said, well, they're grapevine cuttings. And where'd you buy them? So I had a nursery in mind, so I told him the nursery. And the next question was, how much did you pay for them? And out of my mouth comes, in Canadian or American? And he looks at me like, you are the dumbest fucking smuggler. The look on his face is like, man, you're stupid.
Yeah.
Get up to my office.
Because so, this is the U.S. customs.
Yeah. And I answer Canadian or American. Not only did I screw up there a couple of times, but I also had my briefcase with all of my transactions the previous two or three days.
Hmm.
There weren't any names or anything on things, but there was some receipts, you know, the standard receipt books of, you know, 500 of this, clone one, all this kind of stuff, and little things.
So detailed receipts.
The detailed receipts.
So, no names, but no they, were detailed.
They were detailed.
As you can imagine, those receipts could pose a real problem. How did he get around that? Or did he? Now, Chapter 3, Arrest Development. You may recall that John feared they may find detailed receipts of his grapevine purchases in his briefcase, further strengthening their case of smuggling. How could it get worse? Oh, it does.
So he's got all that stuff. And in there was 10 United Parcel receipts, the yellow receipts that they give you when you would ship a box of shoes, that I shipped 10 boxes of shoes from Buffalo.
Yeah.
To my shoe store.
He holds his fingers up like, quotes, shoes.
Shoes. So there's these 10 carbon copies. So the guy's interrogating me. I can't tell him anything, for God's sakes. And he's getting kind of frustrated. And he's looking at all my stuff. And I never forget when he picks up the 10 carbon copies. And he kind of looks at this and goes, I see here in the last 2 or 3 days, you sent 10 boxes of shoes to Yountville. Where's Yountville? And I said, it's in Napa Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling these weren't shoes. No, I have a shoe store there, and I was just buying closeouts in Buffalo. And yeah, okay, well, I'm going to trace those. So he puts them down in front of me and goes in the next office. He's about 15, 20 feet away. And he's leaned over a desk with his buddy, and they're trying to figure out which phone number to call.
Hmm.
United Parcel. And they're really intent on, should we call this number? Should we go? And they're not looking at me. So I had to make an executive decision. This was crucial.
Yes.
Because I would have lost everything.
It's a pivotal moment.
This was one of those, exactly. So I looked at that stack. He wasn't watching. I reached over. I crumbled them up. And I ate them.
Destroyed the evidence.
And it was gone. I mean, when he walked back in, I still had a little bit kind of tucked up here. I hadn't swallowed it yet. Should have asked him for a glass of water, really, but anyway, I didn't. And so he's looking around the desk and nothing there. And he goes, Joe, you didn't bring any. All right, what'd you do with those? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, where are those receipts? I don't know. Didn't you? All right, Joe, we got to take him in the back room and frisk him. So they take me in the back room, put me in a little toilet room. I have to take on my clothes, and he looks, of course, I ate them, so there wasn't anything in my pockets. Made me bend over. He throws me my clothes. Get your clothes back on, get back in my office. I might be going to jail here. This is not good.
Yeah.
So now he's coming down hard on me. I want you to tell everything. I want to know who's behind this, or you're going to jail. I want you to start talking. So I said, can I make a phone call? And that's when I had Richard's card, an attorney.
Richard Lyon.
Richard Lyon, and you know, his wife is my mule, for God's sake. So I call him, and he answers the phone, and hello. And I said, hi, Richard. John, where are you, for God's sakes? Kathleen and I are still waiting. What is going on? Well, I'm still at the border. I got caught. All right. I think I said I got stopped. He goes, ooh, not good, John. Not good. But just relax there for a second. I'm going to be calling you back. Okay. Well, put the phone down. Guy's beating on me. You're going to jail. Phone rings. He picks it up. He starts talking. He got a real serious look on his face. Kind of leaned back in his chair. And he goes, and you want me to release him? In the carriage line. Okay. Goodbye. Puts the phone down, took someone look at me, and he goes, I don't know who in the hell you know, but that was my boss, and I'm to release you, so get your stuff and get the hell out of here.
Man.
I can go, yes, get out of here. So I get my stuff, and I walk out.
I've seen that scene in movies before.
Yes.
And I was like, who do you know?
Who do you know? The look on his face was like,
who do you know?
You had one lifeline, and it worked out for you.
Oh, my God. It worked out. A little sidelight. I don't know if you read, but when I'm walking out, my 1,300 or 1,400 vines are in this. They had them stacked in the hallway as I'm walking out. I'm walking by them.
Oh.
And I'm looking at my babies. Those are my babies, right? And I stopped. Two guys are behind me. And I turned around, and I had my little wavos came back just a little bit. And I said, is there any way I can get the fuck out of here? We're going to destroy those. Okay. I thought maybe I better not press this anymore.
You pressed enough.
Don't press that. So I go out.
And you'd already resigned yourself to the fact that you were losing those.
Exactly. So I get in my car, drive back, and sitting in their living room half an hour later, and Richard asked me if I wanted a little Jack Daniels, and I said, oh, I'd love some. So we were sipping that, and I said, what happened today? And he said, well, he had a little smirk on his face. He said, I'll never forget the look. He goes, you were pretty lucky today. Back in law school, one of my best friends, Richard Pine, is now head of customs for the state of New York, and I called and I got your ass out of that tight situation.
Dang.
Isn't that a cool story?
Yeah, that is serendipity to its extreme.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's like, wow. Anyway, so they arrived that was Sunday, and all 10 boxes arrived on, I think, Tuesday morning, and I was to fly in Tuesday. And that summer we planted them. It was a really good take. I think we only lost 143 vines out of 43 or 4,400 vines.
We don't need to go into it, but there was some concern for quite a while.
I was paranoid as hell.
They were going to go to your shoe store, go through your inventory or look for boxes, and they were going to come to your house and look for more the other vines. And you got through all that, and it did happen, but you got around it.
I just lucked out there, too.
Yeah.
The morning that I buried the vines.
You buried them under an oak tree.
Right, yeah. And
that's a big hole, I would think.
That was a pretty good size. Well, I didn't dig it. My boys dug it.
Okay. Yeah.
But I put them in the plastic bags and laid them in, and they put the soil over the top. And so it was a good place to store them and safe, you know, and nobody would know. But I was really paranoid. Every time a CHP helicopter would go over, if I'd see a car going down here on 4th Avenue, a black car, I thought they were spying on me.
Mm-hmm.
I have to take them out of the ground because it's starting to warm up.
Right, and once they start to...
If they start pushing, you're dead. You have to plant them within 2 or 3 weeks or they'll all die.
Yeah.
So I was waiting for the slaughterhouse. It used to be Ragushi up here. They're a winery now.
Right.
Well, that was a slaughterhouse. Mm. They were in the cattle business And I was waiting for... I didn't want to bring them downtown where everybody stored their vines at the ice house because I thought they were spying on me.
Yeah.
And so I'm waiting for Ragushi to open up. Pretty soon I get a call at the end of February. Okay, John, we got some space. So I go out and dig them out of the ground, put them in the back of my dad's van, and drive down, parked here. And it was my dad's van, and I'm paranoid, so I wanted him to take them up to Ragushi, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're standing out in front, just where you parked, that's where the van was.
Uh-huh.
And you could see right down to 4th Avenue. And at that moment, my dad and I are talking. He's getting ready to take them up to Ragushi. 4,300 vines in the back of his van. California Division of Food and Ag pickup drives down 4th, takes a left, comes down Cruiser Lane. And I said, Dad, that's CDF. My God, they were watching me. It must have been those helicopters. So I freak out, and I jump in the van, and I try to back it in that garage where my trooper is.
Yeah.
The black one there? Okay. So I headed backwards into that, and you know it's a pretty low ceiling. And I didn't think how low it was, and I got halfway in and beer canned the roof about 2 inches. So now I'm sitting...
I heard a horrible screeching sound.
Oh, it was terrible. And since I probably had pretty good speed coming in, I jammed it. I mean, there was no way to get it out. So I'm sitting in front of I thought it was over with. This is it. I lost them. After all of this, I've lost them. So Joel King comes driving up and parks right in front of me, sees me in the van. Oh, there's John.
So he parks right in front, gets out, I get out, shakes my hand. Hi, John, there's some papers for you to sign. Okay. Pulls out his little briefcase, opens it up, the front of his pickup. I mean, I'm looking at the vines right there.
Right.
And he goes,
you're
I want you to sign.
No doubt.
Here's one from USDA. You know, we want you to sign. You know, he came across the border at Niagara Falls. Here's one from California Division of Food and Ag, CDFA. Sign here. And here's one from Steve Bartisono, the county ag commissioner, that you imported, you know, illegally, and we retrieved them and destroyed them.
Okay.
Blah, 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 blah.
And were you fined at this point?
So he puts back in his briefcase, puts in his car, shakes my hand, and drives away.
So you just admitted what you did, but you didn't. Did you get fined at all?
Okay. So.
Okay, still to come.
So now he drives away. And I'm watching him. My dad's watching him. And he gets down. Now, I think it's a setup. Because, see, now I have signed, admitted my guilt, right?
Uh-huh.
Admitted my guilt. That now they're going to come and take me out. So, you know, I'm waiting for the SWAT team to cover something, right? He hits the stop sign down there on 4th Avenue, takes a right, heads into town. And I'm just speechless. My dad's sitting there just watching us, too. We haven't said a word. After about maybe, I don't know, 15, 30 seconds or what it seemed like an hour, Dad says, well, I guess you beat it. You want me to take those up to Rigushi? So, that's how it ended.
Wow. Did you have to lower the air pressure in the tires to get the
van
out?
So to get it out, we stalled four tires a little bit.
And that's the trick.
It was just enough, you know, half an inch or three quarters of an inch, and it squirted right out. And
right.
He never fixed the roof. It was always had that nice little beer can dent right on the top.
And every time you see it, you smile.
Of course. That was it's a memorable afternoon.
And then there's a couple of good follow-up stories to this. One, you planted the vines that spring. Two years later, Randy Dunn made some wine. Your grapes were a major component of his wine in 86, and that got a 92 from Robert Parker, the wine critic. Pretty young at that time, I would imagine. And then, after the story of the smuggling and the planting of the French vines, it takes an unexpected lucrative turn where you find clean vines at Davis and eventually become the first American importer of French clones licensed by the French.
That is true. It became the smuggling vines, smuggled vines, were so good that the industry just went. I mean, I sold every bud that I had for 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Normally,
Davis was apparently behind.
Well, there was none available. I was the only one that had different clones of Cab, Merlot, Cab Franc. And so then I turned that into a business, and then that's when I went back to the French and imported from France under license with a royalty that goes to France every year, a whole collection. Now it's over 60 different clones from France.
Nice.
So it turned out great for the industry.
How many vineyards do you think that you're in right now across the valley?
I would say there's probably very few Cabernet vineyards that don't have my 337 or 15 in it. Very few. Almost everyone's got it. All the Harlins and the Colgans and all those have the 337. The Merlot 181, I don't know of anybody that just plants Davis stuff. Everybody plants 181. Hmm. It's a really good Merlot clone. And the Cab Franc 332, there's only one other one. Well, there's two other ones now that I brought in legally later on that are as good or better. But so any Cab Franc's got my 332. So it turned out to be really important for the industry.
What a sense of pride you must have over that.
It really is.
How about that? What an interesting turn of events. If you're not familiar with John, I bet you didn't see that outcome happening. Who would have thought he'd end up being a major contributor to the success of Napa Valley's wine industry? Now, Chapter 5, It Ain't Rocket Science. John went on to make his own wine with his first release in 1997, and he takes it seriously. So much so, the wine prices fall within the luxury and super luxury category.
Yeah, we're at about almost 5,000 cases, and we sell 99.9. 9 direct to consumer.
Wow.
We don't sell.
Well, you have it's an allocation list, I imagine, right?
Yeah, we just sell, and we've been very lucky to sell out mostly every year about 100% of what we make, so it's really pretty cool.
And, of course, you call your club the
Smugglers Club.
The Society of Smugglers. And they probably love being a part of that.
You know, they love using that name, don't they? They love being smugglers.
Sure.
It's really kind of cute as a dickens. I mean, I just think it's great.
I'm also curious about this rocket science that you have, too. It's another brand, and it comes with all kinds of information unrelated to the wine industry.
But unrelated to the wine industry. My wife loves to say, well, my dad was a rocket scientist, and he was. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that we called it rocket science. Another reason is it isn't rocket science.
Yeah.
Okay. If you've got great grapes with good clones and rootstocks, it's not rocket science.
But there's a balance of creativity
and there's
science.
A balance of creativity and science. Yeah. Exactly right. And it's a cool name, right? It's kind of cool.
Yeah. But you provide information on, like, what NASA's doing, and you provide
Yeah, we got we've been
along with that club.
Every year we donate a substantial amount of wine to the Astronaut Scholarship Program. And it's really a fabulous program. It goes to the best kids. 10 to 20 kids are chosen every year. The highest scoring science kids.
The wine is for a fundraising and dinner.
And it's a fundraising dinner. Yeah, you go and you have dinner under the Saturn V, the one that, you know, that took them to the moon for 13 trips or whatever. And it's really pretty. It's pretty cool to be part of that. We donated stuff to Caltech, where Joy's dad was he was a student there, and so it's been kind of cool to be part of the.
Sure.
And I love the SpaceX thing. We went down and went through SpaceX.
Oh, did you?
And I wish I could get Musk to drink more rocket, but he has drunk rocket science, so that it'd be kind of cool if it was the first wine in this.
Did you did you sign up for being one of the first to visit?
Well, I'd love to. Wouldn't that be cool? I don't know if they'd take a GIMP, though. I was trying to think, would I be very good in one of those space suits, trying to get there?
Well.
With my cane, maybe I could.
You're sitting down most of the time, right?
They could carry me as you're sitting down.
Or floating, so.
Or floating. That's right. You just float.
Yeah. You wouldn't even need your cane.
I wouldn't need a goddamn cane.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I told you during the introduction, he can be brash, but also thoughtful and a pleasant guy. I mean, he referred to his wine club members as cute as the dickens. And how about that philanthropic work he's doing with the Astronaut Scholarship Program? With all his luck and good timing throughout his life, it's good to see him using his success to pay it forward. As we ended the interview, I remembered to ask him about having his own barrel maker on staff. As many of you know, they're called coopers. Well, John has a master cooper. So this final part was outside of the interview, but I'll let you listen in.
I think we're the only one in the United States with their own cooper.
I know that.
Master cooper. And he's a master cooper. He's not just a cooper.
There's someone in Sonoma Valley. I can't remember the name right now. They have a relationship with a cooper. And I know Kendall Jackson is part ownership of a French cooper.
Yes. That's
over. That's over there, though.
That's true. But to have your own master cooper on we're the only ones in the whole country. And we go to France once a year and buy wood. We buy trees, actually. We have to bid against, Tarenceau and Sagan Moreau, and we bid against them on small sections of a certain area of France, the Bercy area.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it's been fun.
That's
been a hell of a project. And it really is great to have your own cooper when it comes to, like, tequila or bourbon, because that's all barrel. I mean, that's where barrels are so darn important. Mm-hmm. We can do
that's
all kinds of different
your
things.
Newest endeavor.
Yeah, the newest endeavor.
And a very tasty bourbon that you poured for me.
You want some more?
Sure. Well, you were going to give me that tequila that is.
You want to try that?
Dark as almost a red wine.
For the tequila, there's four of them. Let's line up four glasses. And then that way you can taste them against each other.
Okay, that's as far as that needs to go. So if wine wasn't enough, he shared four bourbons that he calls apple juice, before the interview, then 4 tequilas afterward. They were varying in depth of color from the oak, and one, aged in Cabernet barrels, was as dark as a light red wine, as I mentioned. Both the bourbon and tequila were tasty and smooth. He hopes to get them on the market sometime soon. Now, you may not get bourbon or tequila, but visiting Caldwell Vineyard is well worth the visit. He built a nearly 20,000-square-foot cave where he holds wine tastings. It's a spacious cave with stunning black-and-white images on the walls, many like you see on his website. And the tastings are enjoyable. There's a nice selection of cheese, crackers, even chorizo that goes well with the wines. For more details, visit CaldwellVineyard.com. John fucking Caldwell. I mean, what else are you going to call the guy? The music on today's show was composed by John Russell Bradshaw, Casado Williams, Kieli Minucci, and Emmanuel Collins, Christian Knight, Jeffrey Wade, and Ruben Ayala. The podcast and radio show is researched, written, recorded, and produced by me. The website is onthewineroad.com. Find me on YouTube at On the Wine Road and on Facebook. You can follow me on Instagram and occasionally on Twitter at JD Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis. I hope to catch you again sooner than later on the Wine Road.